Hello and welcome to the MS Improv Podcast, where we engage, where we are mindful, and we tell or share our stories. I'm Eric Chase. We are powered by GEMS. My guest today is going to be a loquacious individual. It's Dr. Marvin Wayne. He's trained in surgery, emergency medicine, and he is an EMS medical director for 50 years, working with a team of individuals throughout that entire time. Without further ado, I want to welcome Dr. Marvin Wayne. Dr. Wayne, welcome.
Yeah. Hello. Good morning. How are you doing today?
I am well, thank you. Here in gloomy Oklahoma, and you're in Maui, Hawaii. And I had to make you get off the balcony. I apologize.
Yeah. I'm over here. This is a little business. I help put together an educational program every December called Current Concepts in Emergency Care that we've been doing now 48 or 49 years. And I'm over for a little of that, and also a little bit of R&R.
Well, I want to thank you first and foremost for being a leader, a visionary, and a collaborator with people, not only in emergency medicine, and yet emergency medical services as well. We have lots of mutual friends and colleagues that through your tireless work at times and the commitment to collaboration has significantly improved emergency medical services. So I just want to say thank you on that note. This is Mental Health Awareness Month, and I got to hear you on Peter Antebi's The Florida EMS Medical Directors Association's podcast directly less than a month ago. And we had talked after that about the possibility of you coming on and sharing some of the stories. As a trained surgeon, and you served in Vietnam towards the end of the war in 1971, you were at the 24th Evac Hospital in Long Binh, Vietnam. You shared some compelling stories, and I know that your mission is, in one case, for us to accept vulnerability of care providers. And that started with you becoming vulnerable and starting to come out of some of the burdens that maybe you've maintained since your service and the things you saw. So I appreciate that as well. And if that's okay, wherever you'd like to start, I appreciate that.
There's so many places to start. The question is, where do we want to begin? So I'm going to give you my quick bio. I was born in Detroit. I went to the famous Mumford High School, where I had three very famous classmates, Cornelius Grant from The Temptations, Jerry Bruckheimer, who is one of the richest producers in the world, his Top Gun Maverick being his latest big movie, and Lynn Shay, who was Magda in There's Something About Mary. And then there was me. I was neither the coolest kid nor whatever. I went on to the University of Michigan. I was fortunate and unfortunate. My father died end of my sophomore year. Finances became an issue. He was a factory worker. And I went on to keep applying to medical school I'd only had 3 years of undergraduate, either because of chance or whatever. I got put on the wait list at the University of Michigan after getting essentially rejected by everybody else. And every Monday morning, went to the dean of admissions office with a box of candy for a secretary and a letter saying, I want to be a doctor. You can make it happen. And then 3 days before class began, he made it happen. So I went to undergrad in Michigan with incomplete. I don't have a bachelor's degree, so sorry, I'm a dropout. Medical school in Ann Arbor. I had a fellowship at the end, an elective time in England. And then I did my surgical training at the University of Colorado. When I finished there, I went on to my Berry Plan requirement of going into military. And next thing I know, I'm in an Army drab uniform that won't fit. So everything I had to get was mini-sized to fit me. It's just, I don't think they ever figured men's army would be very small. So I next found myself at the 24th Evacuation Hospital in Long Binh. The hospital was variably from 250 to 400 beds, depending where we were in the war. And we had pretty much all specialties except OBGYN, that was in Saigon at the third field. We had neurosurgery and they did not. So certain patients went certain directions. in any case, you know, it was there. There were moments of boredom. There was moments of terror. There was moments of pissing people off, which I'm really good at. There was moments of, well, you know, speaking my mind.
Yeah.
And we all did our thing. We worked together and we worked to try to save lives. I got interested in, I'd done 3 months of pediatric surgery over at Denver Children's, and got interested in kids, maybe because they were closer to my size, I don't know. And I found out about an Australian surgical team over at the civilian hospital in Benoit. And Benoit was this large and now much larger city, in fact, where the air base was that we landed in Vietnam. And that's a whole separate issue of stories. I found out about the team. I got the CO to let me go over on my free time. And I worked with these wonderful Australian civilians, taking care of mostly kids at the hospital. We took care of some adults. They mostly did. I kind of focused on the kids. And it gave me an outlet, one. It also gave me an appreciation for how terrible war is. I already sort of knew that. But I remember I wasn't there in 1968, 69 at the height of the war, where there was just multiple casualties every day. So it was kind of a different time. And yet what I was involved with was also a very different environment. You know, I showed the picture of the wards there where the patients' families almost had to care for them. Very limited facilities. And from there, it made especially taking care of kids difficult. But it did. And then the one episode while doing that that was most traumatic for me was when the kids' teaching unlock occurred. I don't remember the exact date. Somebody can look it up in history. It was when there were many sieges in Unlock. Unlock was sort of in central Vietnam, and it was what we called NVA territory, North Vietnamese Army, as well as Viet Cong, which were the rebel forces in the south fighting against the current government. So Vietnam, I would define as a communist agrarian society in the north and a dictatorial society in the south. So pays your money, take your choices, spread your politics. But, you know, I have no positives to say about war. And unfortunately, I have a lot of family in Israel, for example. And so that's another terrible war. Not saying anybody's right or wrong, but I do think, you know, the fact that we haven't been able to get peace in Israel, I don't know. I've been going there for many, many years, and I keep hoping. And I'm not, October 7th was as equivalent to 9/11 as you can get. And I listen to these kids, and I'm going to get a little political here, so you can cut it off if you wish.
No.
I listen to these kids, and I ask one, I said, you know, during World War II, have you studied all about World War II? And they go, a little bit. These are college kids. I said, so if it was today, would you be waving a flag for the Nazis? Not the German people. Let's separate that. Nazis. She said, of course not. I said, well, Hamas, Nazi, ISIS, they're all the same caliber and same type of individuals. I said, you know, my background is Ukrainian on one side and Austrian on the other side. My Ukrainian side got kicked out in the pogroms. My Austrian side got killed in the Holocaust. So, you know, we separation here of understanding what they're talking about. And they don't. This is just another cause, which is I was there in the 60s. Hey, you know, I marched for equality and I fought for rights of people. So however we want to separate that. So back to Vietnam. So, you know, most of the time what we did is what we did. We played, we worked, we slept, and we repeated a variety of cycles. Like MASH, my commanding officer didn't tie flies. He ground stones. He was a lapidarist for much of the time. It was kind of interesting. And our assistant chief, he took outdated blood and fed it to his banana plants. So, you know, like little shop of horrors almost.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff. I also went at night and would bake over in the mess tent, which is a totally different story, not for today. But one of the things that I learned, one, is I don't know how to keep my mouth shut, as you're very well hearing. And two, there is a time to keep your mouth shut. So I would, from time to time, get into a variety of trouble opening it. But one of the efforts I made was to try to get some of our semi-outdated saline antibiotics and the like and bring it over to the provincial hospital to be used, because we are totally inadequate as far as equipment, supplies, medications. Was a little bit successful. And then working with the Australian team taught me a lot about other places in the world and about people in other places in the world to go to help other people in other places in the world. And these people were civilians. We had Australian military. I mean, there were a lot of Australians, especially around Vung Tau, another area of Vietnam. And likewise, we also had Thai, RTA, Royal Thai Army. And then we had Iraq, Royal Army of Korea. They were very tough soldiers. But all in all, these were civilians I worked with, and we worked at the provincial hospital in Bin La, and we took care of people. Now, that kind of unlocked siege, and I guess you'd have to go back and say which unlocked siege, because as I went back looking in history, there were many. For some reason, unlocked was an area that could be sieged and was difficult to defend from the inside and get to from the outside. And that particular siege, there were 21 of the people that were brought out that we ended up in the provincial hospital, because routinely military hospitals, with exception, didn't take civilians that were Vietnamese, unless they were part of the Vietnamese armies. Okay, so we took care of North Vietnamese army people. We took care of South. We took care of Viet Cong. We took care of all of the above. And when you walked through the doors of the hospital, you were called patient. And that was something that for a lot of people was hard to understand. You had to separate it. There was no easy way to do it otherwise. So anyway, that particular group of patients and patient times with the kids was really emotionally draining on me, because I was going back and forth, and the Aussies, you know, of course, were short-staffed for the amount of that particular bundle of patients that came in. Now, why did it particularly affect me? I don't know. I didn't have children. At the time, I had done some pediatric surgery. At the time, most of my world had been civilian. I don't know. It did. And, you know, that plus so many other things, somewhat self-inflicted on me by what I did or didn't do, just really cumulatively, whoa, get that word out fast early in the morning with only 1.5 cups of coffee, you know, just had its effect. And so that's where Peter and I, kind of that Florida EMS podcast, or it's actually a podcast, it's video. You know, we had talked at the time of Parkland, the anniversary of Parkland, about, you know, his worst day concept. And I told him about my worst day. It wasn't civilian. It was, well, they were civilians, but it was when I was in Vietnam. And he said, would I be willing to talk about it? And, you know, as much as I'm very good about talking about everything, because I always have an opinion, and of course, mine's are always right.
Of course.
Not real. Well, my commanding officer certainly didn't think so. In any case, you know, I said, sure. And then that podcast kind of came on. First time, some of it was old. I, you know, showed pictures, but that particular emotional expression from that siege, and when it came, of course, this is Mental Health Month, and it came at a time when both of us were remembering bad times, and that was times of the death of children. Peter has done so many amazing things toward improving pediatric care. I can't thank him enough for that. We use all of his products. And we have become very good friends, because there's, again, I remind people, there's no I in we. We all do this together to better care for our patients. Anyway, so I, you know, I tried to get help. You really, you know, the way that most people over there expressed their emotions was either drinking a little more Jack Daniels, which you could buy very cheaply at the PX, or inhaling some tetrahydrocannabinoid, which you could also buy out the back door and hopefully not get a pee test. We'd get woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning and get out of the OR and just get to sleep, and somebody bang on my door and say, pee test. Excuse me. And you know, you'd come out and you'd pee in a bucket or a bottle, of course, and they'd run it for drugs. And I don't know what happened if you came back. And they'd have a big urn of coffee. If you're having 3 o'clock in the morning, all I want to do is go back to bed. Fortunately, I've always had the ability to make my bladder work, sometimes too much, but and that's TMI. And so I would pee, and but a variety of responses to people's positive tests. I guess we're drug dependent. So in any case, you know, we had our parties. We had what we call purple alerts. So if times were not real super busy and somebody was motivated by the sign entrance sort of to the hospital, we'd put a purple helmet. That meant that there was going to be a purple alert party that night. And usually word of mouth told people where. It was not illegal. It was just an impromptu gathering, like a pop-up. And there was usually a mixture of themes sometimes. Sometimes there was costumes. Sometimes there was who knows. And sometimes it got interrupted by actually having to work. So that brings me to sort of the round track of what do we do for people today? Or what did we do with people who came home from Vietnam? Many of them, as we've all seen the movies, but again, it's like watching a war movie. You see it, you may see the blood spurting, but you don't smell it. And you don't literally, as the permeation of the air, you don't taste it because there is that permeation. And there's nothing worse than burns and burned flesh. And we can think of all so many ways to inflict terror on people. I am a believer that there's always got to be a better way. Unfortunately, geopolitics does not allow that better way frequently. And I'd like to be able to turn to my neighbor and say, hi, neighbor, instead of I hate you, neighbor. And we're, again, not very good at that. And then once we mix in politics with geopolitics, it gets even worse because it gets perpetuated for a variety of reasons. So again, I'm not trying to be political. I'm not running for any office. Most of the time I'm running for help. Sometimes I'm running for the bathroom, who knows? you know, at my age. But you know, that's sort of brings us somewhat full circle. Today I direct with others, City County MS system. And when I got there in 74, was a private service that killed more than helped. We underwent our internal geopolitics. Everybody loved and hated each other. It took us forever to get 911. But we've evolved. We, in spite of sometimes wars between unions and guilds and departments and politicians from the city and the county, we have a pretty much integrated city-county MS system. We are very aggressive in our protocols because we cover 2,500 square miles. Excuse me. Hang on a sec. We cover a very large area, so we have to have a certain level of independence because some of our transport times are 15 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 minutes, and 2 hours. We go up from the ocean, or the bay actually off the ocean, to 10,400 feet Mount Baker. A lot of people are climb up in the mountains. We have a ski area. So we have to be multifaceted in our approach to care. And as I remind everybody, care is what we provide. Caring is what we have to have as a state of mind. So anyway, I'll shut up for a minute and let you ask more questions. Sorry, got me rolling there.
Marv, first of all, don't apologize. I hear and feel simultaneously the histrionics of what you've experienced, from politics to war. Visceral smells and sensations have come to my mind as I heard you talking, you know, whether it be burns or injuries and that type of thing. And then also having to have a well well accommodated unit, or in this case, you know, you're talking about EMS and medical direction training and experience and knowledge and that ongoing. If we go back in a minute, I wanted to ask you, how did the impact of OnLock, the siege there, where you had 21 pediatrics or children, and 19 of them died, how does that, and how did that impact how you integrated into emergency medicine when you came back to the States and as an EMS medical director now for 50 years?
Well, look, you can't focus on one event or one thing. It does everything. Okay. OnLock was just the worst day or worst week, so to speak. Because, by the way, there were lots of people that died at OnLock that were not, they were not part of what we took care of. We took care of a group of children, and how they ended up at the provincial hospital, I can't answer that. I really don't know. Because remember, that was not military. That was civilian. That was under an Australian surgical team working with the Vietnamese. But being all very honest, the Australian team provided much of the surgical care and surgical technique and skills. And that was just a component. I can't, you know, I can't enough emphasize that I did learn and sometimes didn't learn the team approach, and maybe some of that carried over. So, because when I came back, so I went to Fort Carson Army Medical Center and worked there, and somewhere along the line got married, kind of in between. And my, fortunately, I'd been in Denver and I met my now wife for now, what, 53-ish years at Denver General. She was a social worker, and we treated her so poorly. She reminds me occasionally. And I felt sorry, so we took her up skiing. She said, I only went out with you because you got me a free ski ticket. And of course, that's long history, two children. My older daughter lives in Israel, as I said. I have six grandchildren, a grandson-in-law, and maybe one day I'll have great-grandchildren. And I've been teaching and working with the Israeli medical components, who, again, all the geopolitics there, I don't even want to get into. It's some of the best and some of the worst that you'll ever see. But I, again, it's like our leadership, their leadership, the world's leadership. It's, you can point fingers, but I'd rather point healing, and I'd rather point cordial relationships. But again, how much cordial relationship did we have with the Nazis in World War II? Think about that. Or how much cordial relationships do we have with ISIS or the Taliban when they blew up the World Trade Center? So there are many components and sides that efforts to get people together. I thought many years ago, over 35 years ago, when I first went to the Middle East, we might see some sort of abilities, but you know, there's always been somebody who wanted to push whatever, the wrong button. And that button has led to so many wars. Will we ever see peace? I don't know. I fear not in my lifetime, but I would hope in my lifetime.
So with that hope, and I appreciate you sharing, and this has covered a lot.
I need to stop you and say one thing. I am not waving any flags for anybody but hope and health. I am Jewish, okay? My family lives in Israel. Yeah. I am very much pro positive thing. I've been teaching for years with the Israeli medical people, and working with some of the IDF folks. I do a program with American Physicians for Israel. We sent forensic pathologists over right after October 7th. We've sent rehab, ortho, lots of other docs that were well needed. But I'm not pro any war. I don't care where it is. Unfortunately, the realities of the world don't allow me to have my wishes. You know, if I would wish, I would be, you know, maybe 6 feet tall, handsome, and not 80 years old. But, and better at wing foiling than I am. but you know, just it's a shame. But it's reality. I mean, I can, again, I wish that World War II didn't happen. I wish that my whole family didn't die in the Holocaust in the Viennese side here in Vienna, in Austria. I wish so many things. I wish we could figure out a way to have peace. I'm not real optimistic, and I try to balance realism with hope.
Wow. Balancing realism and hope is something that I try to do, what we try to do with our applied improvisation, and being as authentic to ourselves as possible, being collaborative, failing, getting back up. When you're dealing with this, when you're trying to balance that, that realism and hope, and you continue to highlight all of these wars and death and senses that you've experienced, do you ever see the wins? And if you do, what would you name a win that you've been able to extrapolate from the horrors and the catastrophes that you've borne witness to, that you're implementing as a medical director for your team, for other medical directors? And I know that you work and you send aid and you participate in training and helping and responding. What are some of the things that you've given with that measure of hope, despite the realism of what's going on and the atrocities that are occurring globally, even in our neighborhoods and our communities, to try to stamp that out at least and see or feel that there's some positive impact? Because you talked about impact significantly on how it's impacted your life.
Okay, well, to begin, I don't even know where to begin. So I'll try to begin somewhere. So we do, there are positive things that come out of war. I know that doesn't sound like, that sounds like a dichotomy of dichotomies. You know, we learned combat care. We learned rapid care. We learned the use of fluid and resuscitation and over-fluid resuscitation. We had, you know, Da Nang Long. I was in Long Bin. Da Nang was another city where I spent 3 nights getting rocketed as I was trying to get home. But we learned that we gave too much white stuff to people. Scaling. You know, we created ARDS. That's where it was first well described. Maybe in 1969, 89, somewhere in there, ARDS syndrome. And we tried to learn, because we were the early days of ventilators and PEEP and all these things. You know, I used a bird. I used a Mersch, which was the first volume ventilator, and lots of things of that nature. But I also think we learned, you know, rapid extrication of patients. Well, Korea began the helicopter, for those of you who watch MASH, because you got to watch MASH. Mm-hmm. The irreverence, there might be some carryover to Vietnam. I won't name names. And the ability to get patients from there to here rapidly, and the rapid applying, and then transfer that to some way to the civilian world. Now, I have to be honest, I'm a big proponent of rapid evacuation and have worked with Air Medical. First, we had our own program called MedFlight. Now we amalgamated into Airlift Northwest. And the problem is a lot of the programs have become what I would call a dash for cash, where they're more interested in the acquisition of a patient for what they can produce dollar-wise. I'm not pointing fingers. I know some really, Airlift is, I've worked with for years now. They're great. You know, they've got an insurance program. We've actually, I shouldn't say this because somebody will be listening. We've actually got people to sign up for AirCare, which is their insurance program, as they lay on a gurney at the ski area, so that flight off the mountain, if they're American, if they're US, not, unfortunately, a lot of them are Canadian, that flight off that mountain would be much, 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 much less expensive. So they're really geared toward caring for people. I can't speak for other programs, but I certainly can give Rich Ultranachet and the other people in the leadership kudo for that approach. Now, the rapid evacuation. We were anti-tourniquet, to be honest with you, at the start of Vietnam, and we're coming around toward the later days of Vietnam. And of course, the tourniquet has turned out to be a very important tool. So we, you know, blood stopper box is next to the AED. And some other day, we'll tell you the original AED story, because I'm the idiot that used it first out of a hospital in October of 74. And that is completely an added story, because I didn't know better. And now 10 years to get it, well, 6 years to get it published and 10 years to get it accepted. But again, that was an idea that we could make a difference. So in any case, you know, how we treated patients, rapid extrication to medical care, overflying medical facilities to get to the right level of care, skill, teamwork. Remember, I keep emphasizing that there's no I in we. The team has to do it because that's what makes the difference in patient care. We try to expand that to EMS. You know, every EMS agency has a group of individuals who are the quote unquote experts in everything at any level you want. And sometimes they're experts in nothing because, you know, X and spurt, the two components of the word. But those that are willing to team with others and learn from each other are ones that give great care, you know, and that's just sort of, and I've learned, try to learn to keep my mouth shut. My father told me once, and he was absolutely 100% correct. You know, he had just high school education. He'd been in the Flying Tigers in World War II and shot down and lots of things. And long bottom line is he died at 47 of a cardiac arrest. But he told me one time, if you keep your mouth shut, people won't know how stupid you really are. And I've been proving him right on that one for a long time by opening my mouth. So, you know, we try to make differences. And I look around the country and the world with the people I've had the opportunity to both work with and learn from. And there are so many amazing people in the world that want to care and provide care and caring for the patients. Now, sometimes, as I said, we forget to provide that for ourselves and our colleagues. I've always felt that nobody should be fearful of asking for help. And yet, there's still a stigma. It still exists today. Now, one of the things that we've done, I'll backtracking here a little bit. We started in 74, probably about 79, 78, 79. We learned about a support officer program that had been started in Baltimore. I can't remember who the leader was there, about where at bad events, they would send out specially trained individuals. At the time, they were mostly clergy, but not coming out as clergy, to help families, to help the EMS provider, and the like. We started our own program around, I think it was around 1980, and I may be wrong, because memory goes pretty quickly. And today it still exists. So we have an echo call. Part of the echo dispatch is to notify a support officer. So we have many of them around the county, and they have one that's always on call, and we have backups. And so especially for those involving children, so we pop back. We had a call not too long ago in which there was a three-month-old found in semi-cardiac arrest. And immediately to that call, because of its characteristic, support officer was dispatched. Now, the support officers generally come in. They come in as support officers. They're specially trained. They, whether they're clergy, mental health, or what, they come in wearing a jacket or slicker or something that says support officer, doesn't express any religious inclination or concept. And they know, you know, about how to work with families, how to deal with death, what the limitations are for the medical examiner, for example, you know, and they help families through this critical time. We also, and we send a battalion chief to our echo call because their job is many faceted. That and our EMS supervisors are also there, not just for the patient, but for their family, if there's family, or if there's multiple patients. So we're trying to provide a daily care and caring approach to things. So, and again, it's growing. I've added wonderful people around me, and the people around me have added me. Some days they're glad to see me, and other days they're going, crap, he's here again. So who knows?
I love hearing that. And that comes from, I think, that juxtaposition of realism and hope, because sometimes it can seem so so far apart, like the Grand Canyon from end to end, the ability to make sense of things. And sometimes we might not make sense of them. And yet if we start dealing with them immediately, it helps minimize or reduce that cumulative trauma, as we know.
Yeah.
Go ahead, please.
But I, one thing I just want to say, I am probably a lot worse and certainly no better than anybody else is. You know, I'm not able to get up on whatever pulpit for religion, non-religion, anti-secularism, pro-secularism, or whatever, and be the prophet. I'm definitely not that. I talk a lot. Maybe sometimes something useful comes out. But this is not, again, a one. This has to be a we approach to things.
With that we approach to things, you had said something, and I don't know who to give attribution to. You had said it, and it may have come from a family member. If you never make waves, you will never change the shape of the world. And I have seen that and read about you and heard about you from Stephen and Peter and other people that we both know, about your tenacity to speak out, speak up, even if it's made some kind of waves in order to change the landscape or the shape of your world, whatever you're dealing with at the time, whether it be politically appropriate in people's minds or otherwise needing to be said. First of all, was that attribution directly to you, or was that a family member or something that you had heard?
Yeah. Well, my family, my father at one point said something to the effect, if you make waves, you're going to hit rocks. So you're going to get kicked back. But if you never make waves, you'll never change the shape of the world. And it's just kind of a conglomerate of his comments and my comments. And I'm an expert at hitting rocks. I can tell you that. I've hit a lot of rocks. I don't know how much I've changed the shape of the world, but if I've changed one person's life, you know, in the Talmud, you say saving one person's life is as if you saved the world. And that's something, a quote that is sort of irreligious in so many ways. Because whether you believe or don't believe in anything, saving one life is as if you were saving the world. You know, somebody saved somebody who went on to do something. You know, you. I mean, you're the example. You know, you've had your share of issues, your cardiac arrest and everything else. You know, and we've all, at one point or another, somebody saved our one life in some way, shape, or form. And hopefully we've gone on to do something sequentially to help save others, whether it's nothing more than doing your job better. It's nothing more than taking care of your family. It's nothing more than having some role in your community. It's nothing more than just, again, being a caring person.
I can't thank you enough for saying that, articulating that, feeling that. I want to retrospectively go back and then rebound quickly to the present. When you were dealing with or not dealing with or disassociating from or working on, you know, in your era, counseling was called a sign of weakness. And the inability to care for yourself, I don't know if that made it more difficult to care for other people in your personal experience. I know seeing that in my own, that I seem distant and I seem unable to really truly engage at times with others. You had mentioned today, please support and help each other. Caring and counseling is not weakness. So Marv, we had been talking and I had asked a question about the impact and about seeking help as a sign of weakness, the kind of mantra that you were led to believe. And you were talking about, well, you've started in 1976 and how you send people out. With that being said, for the people that don't know the answer, did you start getting help? Did you start talking about the events that you bore witness to, that you experienced, and the things that you saw? And I think that's important for people to hear if you did that yourself.
Yes, yes, and no. I never drank. You know, and as far as using THC, all I had to do was get in a room with 20 other people. It wasn't very big and inhale the air. But, you know, I was never much of a drinker, so that was never my outlet. I tried to talk with our psychiatrist. Let's go back to Vietnam. And I'm not sure who was more screwed up, he or I, because that was usually the guy that got sent there. You know, it's kind of like a jury. You know, the guy that gets on the jury is the guy that wasn't smart enough to get off out of the jury, mm-hmm. although that's I think getting less true today. But a little bit. And what I mostly did was just become more of an annoyance for some people. I think part of my annoyancism, which is always good, got better. And I'm just not sure when I came back. My kind of anti, trying to think the right word. I had trouble with people that were leaders or in charge that were more incompetent than competent. And I was not often afraid to say something, which never endeared me to my commanding officer. But I only had that 1 year to finish up at Fort Carson. And from there, you know, I've always been somebody who was willing to state what I thought and what I always thought was in the best interest of the patient. Sometimes that was misinterpreted as what was in my best interest. Hopefully it wasn't the case, but one never knows. And I was never able to follow my dad's advice to keep my mouth shut. So unfortunately that goes on today. The people that know me will assure you there's never, as you notice, I never have any hesitancy to talk. But I also have a lot of desire to care. And if I can share both my accomplishments, which were always limited because all of our accomplishments have some limitation, and we always, our accomplishments always have more desire, and with a realism, a dose of realism, I hope that helps others. People are going to, I'm not sure how exciting this podcast is going to be to listen to, because sounds like more of a downer. What's not? Life is not a downer. I'm fortunate enough to outlive most of my family, or unfortunate, I should say. My mother was 59, my sister was 61. You know, and I've tried to kill myself doing my stupid sports. My latest attempts are at pickleball, which maybe will ruin the world's most dangerous sports. And I'm working on learning the wing foil, which if you don't know what it is, look it up. And I'm kind of at the point of life to, I'm trying to share my knowledge and mistakes, which I call, try to tell the medics and everybody, I call these learning experiences, but hopefully you only learn them once. And if you have repeated learning experiences, maybe you need some other form of counseling or learning, or relearning, I guess is the right word. Because I think most people really want to do the right thing. I think there's just a very, very small percentage of people that just are out for themselves.
I would tend to agree, and I'm a big proponent of normalizing those accountability conversations. As a leader, as a friend, as a peer, and as an associate, just as a human being, and all too often under the rule of authority or leadership or management, we take off the human name tag, and we take on the role of the person. And I think you can do and have both. With the time that we have left, you chose emergency medicine, and then did EMS choose you, or did you choose it? I was curious.
All right, 30, try to do this in 30 seconds. 1973, I was doing a fellowship year at Virginia Mason in Seattle in surgery. Did not like what I was doing. I'll summarize it real quick. Wasn't happy. I had done some moonlighting in Colorado Springs at Fort Carson, at Fort Carson ERs. I needed to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. Heard about an opening in a little hospital called St. Luke's in Bellingham, which was at war with the other hospital called St. Joseph's. Luke's was a community hospital. Joseph was a religious order hospital. Went up there to work for 1 year, 50 years now. Got dragged into EMS by many members of the community. And next thing I know, we're battling substandard private service, and we're opening up public service. And from there, the rest is 50 years of interesting history. The goods, the bad, the highs, the lows. But most of all, the patients in whose lives we made a difference. I worked in the ER, did a little surgical stuff in the beginning, still have done a lot of stuff along the way, and helped invent some medical devices. And, you know, I'm still me, good, bad, or indifferent. My wife some days wants to go, yeah, I'm not sure if it's in good, bad, but it definitely is never indifferent.
Outstanding. Marv Wayne, ladies and gentlemen, has had a life full of experiences, not unlike some of you. We've talked about Parkland, we've talked about war. For those of you that have heard any of these messages and they bring up feelings, Marv is instrumental in his desire for you to be cared for. And if you need to reach out, get help, know that help is available. Suffering in silence is more painful, and it's the noises that we play in our minds are and can be deafening. I want to thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Marv Wayne, I want to give you the last thing to say before I do my outro, if you're okay with that.
Sure, I don't know how much more there is to say, except that if people take the time to listen to this, I bet the components of it they can translate to their own lives. There is nothing special about me that is any different than anybody else. It's only the direction. You know, as a good friend of mine once said, the questions never change as we go through life and as we go through the years. No matter what the topic is, the questions never change, but the answers continually evolve.
Well, this is and has been the EMS Improv Podcast, where we've engaged, where we've tried to be mindful, and we've heard and told some stories. I'm Eric Chase. We're powered by GEMS, and I want to thank you, Dr. Marv Wayne.